this week, highlights. Highlights of a big year in the world of economics with some of our favourite interviewees. Little snippets that tell a bit of an audio story. Hopefully keep you awake, a little bit entertained, and perhaps even fired up to continue the battle to share in the Earth's rights.
Bumper sticker, charge people for the values they take, not for the values they create.
The fact is that the primary premise that's taught in every economics book and every political science book is wrong. And that premise is nations act in their own self-interest or the interest of their people under democracy. And number two, that in a democracy, voters are going to vote for their self-interest. Now, if voters really voted for self-interest, and elected officials that acted in the national interest to help the voters, then the world would not be the way it is. So the question is, how did the world get this way, where countries and populations are not voting their self-interest, where they seem to be voting for the interest of other countries and for bankers, and for a kind of a economic dynamic that's exactly the opposite that they believe in? Most people believe the world should be more equal, as you're indicating. Most people say that everyone should have the same opportunity. But the society we're in is just the opposite, where society is getting more and more unequal, where wealth is polarizing between creditors and debtors, and between creditor countries and debtor countries. And how can you possibly explain all of this? This should be what economics really is all about. How to explain why the world is diverging from what you'd think it's supposed to be. And yet that topic doesn't even come up in economic studies.
The main birth of conservative think tanks was during the 80s and 90s. I guess what's changed is that some of those issues that think tanks worked on before, such as privatisation, are now more pushed by consultants who advise government, and the think tanks have moved on to other issues. So we basically see a shift in what the think tanks are focusing on. So I think that the big boost in corporate funding of think tanks was in the 80s and 90s. But basically I'm trying to show all the different areas, economic and cultural, in which business actually is managing government and managing how the community does things through things like financial influence, public relations, business coalitions, exerting power, and behind the scenes lobbying. And in terms of the influence of business and corporations over government, I mean, I think everyone's had a lesson on that in terms of the mining industry exerting its power just recently.
Ralph Nader said if the oil companies could own the sun, we would have solar energy tomorrow. Solar energy tomorrow.
We care only about getting what we want, no matter what the cost, just like you. Global warming, perpetual war, toxic waste, child labor, torture, genocide, that's a small price to pay for your SUVs and your flat screen TVs, your blood diamonds, your designer jeans, your absurd garish McMansions. Futile symbols of permanence to quell your quivering, spineless souls.
The mining profits this week, the Australian Bureau of Statistics found they were up 63%, whilst the rest of business struggled along on 27% returns on average. How did you view that in light of the big fat mining tax?
Well, it's just a reminder of what anybody with an ounce of scepticism would have realised, and that is the mining companies were crying poor and carrying on about how terrible that tax was and how they'd have to you know, they wouldn't be able to build any new mines, and maybe they'd have to move overseas and so on. They can't actually move mines overseas, which is an important part. They can't move our mines overseas, which is an important part of the argument, really. And they were quite clearly planning a lot more expansion in Australia because we've got these resources and they want to exploit them.
Oh, please, sir, tax me. Please tax me.
Please, Mr. Swan, don't tax the mining companies. Tax the people who give me a job.
G'day, Swanee. Can we put our hand up as small business owners? We haven't been hit enough with our pathetic little taxes that aren't big enough for us, but, you know, back off the miners because they're only making trillions.
We are, each and every one of us, children of this earth. What Darwin gave evidence for is the human being's not from outer space. The fact that we are made out of this earth, we're evolved. We are literally children of this planet. It's as though we're seeds planted coming out. We eat the fruit of this earth and, of course, return to it. This is evidence that this is home. And so it was, for me, a natural next step to declare, well, if somebody is born literally out of this planet, then that must mean they have every indefeasible right to be here, co-equal with every other human being.
The profit from that a private owner of land gets from charging land rent is the same in economic terms as the profits that a slave owner gets by, you know, gathering in the results of the labor of a slave. The thing that's exactly the same in both cases is that somebody else beside the owner of the land or the slave creates the value, but the owner gets to have the value. That by definition, that means that's unearned to him. So slavery created huge unearned incomes. Land ownership, natural resource ownerships, create huge unearned incomes. And that's about 25 to 30% of national and world GNP.
Somebody else is getting it right where his collar ought to be. Somebody else is getting it right where the chicken got the egg.
The economy in Ireland experienced, it's probably its first real boom starting in the mid-1990s and went through to a couple of years ago, a massive explosion in property and land prices came in its wake. And then, of course, a major collapse as the credit situation, as credit became unavailable. And now you've people living and starting to live in quite difficult environments. Friends of mine that borrowed lots and lots of money to invest in speculative ventures in different areas, not just Ireland, England, Europe, everywhere, are now left with essentially bankrupt because the value, of course, of this land has collapsed. It's a difficult thing, when it hits your people personally. I do know of one friend of mine, his partner took his own life about a year ago, again because he couldn't face the situation. And I was told this by a friend of mine who was part of a dinner conversation with me, with his family, and his daughter was saying, isn't that terrible? I'm glad nothing like that could ever happen to us. Well, her father is in a not much different situation at the moment, and she doesn't realize it yet. We're heading into an environment, particularly in the US and to a lesser degree in Canada, where our economic future as it stands today is unsustainable.
How can we control bubbles? Now, the conventional economics doesn't have a very good fix on that at the moment, but I think all economists know that that's one of the great challenges. So you're right that we've had these financial bubbles, asset price bubbles they are really, and that they have exposed the weaknesses in conventional economics. And you're also right to imply that we haven't figured out how we can control that. But it's quite clear that having bubbles that burst where house prices go through the roof and then they collapse, that's a real problem.
You know, I am so glad you asked me that question.
So over the years since the late 80s, we've actually quantified the Australian property market. It's a bit hard to get the figures. And in fact, this figure that we released on Monday for the Australia's total property market was for 2010 financial year was $327.4 billion. Well, how does that fit into any picture? Well, what we've done is we've collected all the figures since 1972, and we found that any time the ratio of total property sales to our GDP goes beyond 18%, you're in a bubble. Well, that happened in 1973, 1981 and 1988. But it's happened with a vengeance from 1999 right through to now. We've been in a bubble ever since this time.
And how much extra money have we had to spend on real estate?
Well, the total amount that we spent on real estate was something like, well, it was exactly $2.76 trillion in that period. But we estimate that the amount above the 18% bubble line, which if history is a guide, has got to be deleveraged, that's $805 billion. Now, we had the Commonwealth Bank and people saying that there is no bubble and there's no problem, but $805 billion, that's 80% of our GDP, and that's got to be sometime deleveraged. And this one's undoubtedly been the residential peak of all peaks. Now, for those people that think that, you know, China's going to get us out of this, Australia, India and China have all experienced a bubble, and it's just a matter of timing.
And you have fabulous work that's been done on calculating the amount of land rent for Australia. I use that work by Brian Kavanaugh all the time, those graphs that show that land rent is one-third of GDP, and that because that has been privatized and not captured for public benefit, you have taxation on top of that, that vast increase of land costs, hence housing costs, and it very clearly shows the root cause of the rich-poor gap in Australia, but that's transferable to most every place.
The job creators in the economy are the small business because they have very little capital and resources, and so they have to use them very intensively. So they're the ones who provide the jobs. And if you give money to the rich, they're not going to provide jobs because they're going to invest in racehorse stables or things like that that don't provide a lot of jobs. And the capital is cut off from the poorer people. And when you go into a lot of deficit spending like we're doing now, this is dandy for the rich folks because we're giving them lots of nice, safe treasury bonds to hang on to. And if they're hanging on to treasury bonds, then they are not investing money back into the economy. The conservatives always accuse the liberals of being tax and spend, but the conservatives are borrow and spend. And the borrowers and the recipients of the spending tend to be the same folks at the top of the heap.
This the administration is celebrating, taking the victims of Republican economic policy, taking the living, breathing proof that the Bush tax cuts for the rich do not create jobs, and putting economic bullseyes on their backs as of next December. On the one hand, unaffordable tax breaks for the beneficiaries of the Bush tax cuts made ever more permanent as they threaten to suck $4 trillion out of government revenues in the next decade. On the other hand, an insufficient dead-end unemployment solution for Americans who would actually work for a living, a solution made ever more temporary. The president's own Council of Economic Advisors reiterated the reality that the easiest way to create jobs and keep jobs is to make sure that the unemployed continue to have money to spend. The unemployed, unlike the rich, whom this president has just bowed to, are in fact the job creators. They do not have investment portfolios to expand. They do not have vast savings into which to stuff the government checks. They have to spend the money. The economy is surprisingly simple. If business and the rich won't spend and the middle class can't spend, the only factor left to keep pushing money into the insatiable maw of capitalism is the government. So, should the government give the money to the rich who keep it or to the not rich who spend it?
So the 70s was widely blamed as an oil price shock. You've got a radically divergent view on that.
That's right. I mean, you look at the data. The first claim is that interest rates were lifted because the oil shock caused inflation, which caused the central bank to lift interest rates. Now, that's the Bernanke view in one of his papers. Unfortunately, the increase in interest rates started 9 months in most countries before the oil shock. And in fact, most of the countries were citing the property boom. And one statistic I forgot to mention last night, but was quite radical, was over the from 1970 to 1973, the advances of the property sector increased by 640%. That's terrifying. So that you can understand that when they, in the UK, for example, they had the Competition and Credit Control program, which was designed to revamp the manufacturing sector. Unfortunately, most of that money did not end up investing in the manufacturing sector, and ended up investing in property, and that's how they got their property boom. So that same sort of stuff, ideas are observed in Australia. Whitlam, you know, specifically recognised that the rising in interest rates before the oil shock was there to target the property boom. You see Japan, another 30% rise in residential property in 1 year, and a 43% rise in commercial property. Again, the bank was very concerned about the speculation that was taking place there. In fact, the government had announced a very widespread infrastructure plan that was going to revamp the archipelago, new highways, new roads, all those sort of things. Speculators went and mopped the entire area up and bought that. And so you can see why in Japan as well there would have been a land speculation boom. In addition to the worldwide deregulation that was taking place, the property bond had come onto the market. These were all worldwide trends. And in America, of course, the real estate investment trusts was where the boom. So that was one argument that, you know, oil shocks cause the downturn because of a rise in interest rates. The central banks were targeting a property bubble that was taking place. Other claims include the wealth transfer effect. Money is recycled and given over to Saudi oil barons. Unfortunately, the problem with that is most of that money was recycled back into the form of real estate in most of the domestic economies, so that argument doesn't stand. The other suggestion is that automobile consumption would have collapsed as a result of the oil shock. Again, there in Australia, it actually increased right after the oil shock, quite a pronounced increase historically as well. So that in America, on the other hand, that started taking place, a decline 9 months before the oil shock, and in fact, right after the oil shock, the consumption of automobiles stabilized for a little while before it resumed its negative decline and then had a swift recovery. And it should be noted that in subsequent oil shocks, car sale consumptions and all that sort of stuff was actually fairly stable or increased as well. So that there should be a degree of symmetry if, you know, oil shocks cause car sales to fall. So all the data seems to suggest that at best the oil shock had no impact. At worst, the impact that it did have was probably secondary. Oh, and my personal view is actually it was completely neutral. If anything, it actually had a positive impact because it gave us a little bit of inflation that would validate debts as well, because inflation allows you to pay off your debts quicker. Or it actually increased output because all these companies were starting to invest in fuel-efficient cars, and the local sectors, energy sectors, were actually starting to employ people. So the argument that oil shocks caused a 1973-75 recession is a bad view, a more monetary George's view that looks at land and finance and the interaction those two have in output, explains why you had all these property companies like Cambridge Credit, Mainline Corporation, you know, the real estate investment trusts liquidating worldwide, and certain manufacturing firms in Japan that had gone into the speculative frenzy of the 1973-75 recession.
As for the PACER Plus negotiations, at this stage, the Australia and New Zealand governments are lobbying to get the 16 regions signed on. At the moment, they've got Vanuatu and Solomon in agreement. They've got the French Polynesia kind of looking, but they're still what's in it for them. And so they're waiting for the rest of them. And the way we actually see it is that they're actually skirting around the small island developing nations and getting them signed on and circling around to come into the big gun, which is Fiji. and by the time they get all those others, they're technically hoping. And, you know, if I'm blowing their cover, I'm really glad. Because I think they should, if they're going to have these PACER Plus negotiations, they need to go straight to the heart and engage respectfully with the Commodore and the existing government, because these backdoor entries into getting these plans across are not going to work for us going forward. When it comes to signing on to the negotiations, they're going to look and they're going to go over those fishing rights details with a fine-tooth comb, and they are not going to be told how and where they're going to fish, because those are our waters. They're not going to mess with them.
That is Emerita Cross from the Global Dialogue Foundation on this Renegades End of Year special. Here's Robert McKelpine, the president of our organisation.
Economic justice. There's plenty of people involved in social justice. But when it comes to economic justice, there's a lot of things that aren't happening as they should be. And I could see it as a property valuer rather than an economist. The economist has a complete disassociation from valuations. One dealing with the abstract theory of value, abstract theory, and the other being concerned with the measurement of value in the marketplace. Now, the two theories have developed over the years along separate and independent lines. It's a bit like real estate agents and property valuers. We're different animals. We deal in real estate, but a valuer is really nothing like a real estate agent. So there's a misconception in some quarters about the value of having a valuer compared with the value of somebody selling real estate. So I came to the conclusion that something had to be done in the field of economics to help people who just aren't able to get their head above water. The origins of an economist and a land valuer were different. One arose from the philosophical speculation of the economy, and the other was brought into being by judicial and administrative necessity. And there's been no attempt to correlate the theories of the two. Using Georgist principles and being a renegade economist, that the government could collect the increase in property values, the unearned increase in property values, on taxpayers' money spent on infrastructure. That'd be one of them. An example of that would be the creation of the fast train between Melbourne and Sydney, and the vitalisation that it would create to the country towns along the way, and of course at Melbourne, where the station is proposed to be at Jolimont, and the other end at Sydney. The part of the cost of creating that could be collected from the unearned increment in property values. Not the lot, but a fair proportion of it. So it's a win-win situation for property owners and municipalities along the way, as well as the ratepayer or the taxpayer who pays for the infrastructure.
John Stuart Mill advocated that. Henry George, of course, advocated that. Milton Friedman conceded that land tax is the best tax. So this isn't some sort of socialist conspiracy. It actually rejects socialism in its absolute form, completely rejects it, because it's saying capital and labour is free to own what it creates, absolutely and entirely. Rents, on the other hand, and this is the great thing, we've got actually a political consensus ideologically between the left and the right on a matter, and we unfortunately are stunned that we cannot implement it because of the vested interests that currently govern society.
As an economist, I loathe monopoly. I regard it as a form of taxation on the productive capacity of the human population in this country.
Plato described an eternal triangle from democracy into oligarchy, where the rich take over, and then into aristocracy as the oligarchy makes itself hereditary, and then from aristocracy back to democracy. So all of this was looked at as the political stage immediately preceding oligarchy. And that was true in classical Greece. So I think anybody who's read Plato in the last 2,500 years should not be surprised at this natural development.
And there we have it. Yes, a bit of end of year highlights of some of the interviews we've done. There must have been over 35 various people on the show. I thank them all very much. A little bit of an anonymous show, but some of the people you just heard were Jeff Smith, Sharon Beter from University of Wollongong and her business managed democracy concept and website. There was some a True Blood sample in there. There was Keith Olbermann, Dave Giesen, Wendell Fitzgerald. Had to slide that one in from last week about the comparisons to wage slaves and, yes, whips and chain slaves. There really isn't much when so much of the value of the community has been appropriated by those who have monopolized the most valuable resource on earth. It's not the oil, it's not the gold, it's actually what we stand on. It's land, and it's land in prime locations, which delivers an unnatural advantage for those who are lucky enough to hold title to it. And the rest of us pay our taxes that fund the infrastructure that make the land we're trying to buy more expensive. So that is the matrix we are locked in. That's why I'm here every week telling you this story that really doesn't get discussed much anymore. Pre-World War I, there were thousands of people who knew this. They would talk about it over the kitchen table, realizing that the mother of all monopolies is land, as Winston Churchill said. And yes, it's with quite some sadness that we sign off this year to the news that Dr. Ken Henry has resigned from the Federal Treasury, and after the ruckus that was caused by his Australia's Future Tax Systems report this year. You heard some debate about the mining tax in that little audio story, and yeah, hopefully he comes and works for us or someone else of high note, and the BHPs and Goldman Sachs don't get him. So that will be a test to see where he goes to in the private sector. He's only 53, but for the discussions that were that he placed amongst those who were thinking about the tax system was very impressive, and we look forward to continuing on some of these discussions. No one really likes to talk about tax, but hey, I appreciate all your support out there in 3CR land. So I hope you have a safe Christmas, and yeah, discover a few new things. Make sure you check out our websites, earthsharing.org.au, prosper.org.au, and if you want to really check out the heavyweights, go to thedepression.org.au or lvrg.org.au. All right, my name's Carl Fitzgerald. Thank you very much for being with us this year. I look forward to seeing you in the new year. A few musical specials coming up over the next few weeks.